Legal Face-Off on WGNRadio.com is brought to you by McCorkle Litigation Services, leaders in court reporting and legal technology.
Hey, what's up, y'all? It's your man Montel Jordan, and this is how we do it. And right now, you're listening to Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. That's right, you're locked onto the high-energy legal podcast with lawyers Rich Lenkoff and Tina Martini, and they're going to be trading jabs on the breaking news and the hottest issues, sports, entertainment, politics. Nothing is off limits. Keep listening, because this is how we do it.
Welcome to another edition of Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. Of course, we have Tina Martini, McDermott, Will, and Schulte, and Rich Lenkoff from Downey & Lenkoff. I'm your moderator, Ryan Burrow. Pete Hegseth, the defense secretary, or secretary of war, I guess, depending on who you ask, has been under the microscope over this report about an ordered second strike to kill survivors following an airstrike on a suspected drug boat in the Caribbean. Lawmakers say he may have committed a war crime. To discuss this further, we head to South Bend, Indiana. Beautiful this time of year. Mary Ellen O'Connell is the Robert and Marion Short Professor of Law and Professor of International Peace Studies, Kroc Institute, at the University of Notre Dame. Her work is in the areas of international law and use of force, international dispute resolution, and international legal authority. And she's written a couple books, author of a few, actually. Author of, most recently, The Art of Law in the International Community and Self-Defense Against Non-State Actors. Mary Ellen, thank you so much for joining us on Legal Face.
Good to be here.
Professor, lots going on with this story, obviously, all week, right? I mean, we're seeing a lot of lawmakers, as Ryan mentioned, dealing with this. Even those that support President Trump, even Republicans, are questioning what happened here, whether there was a lawful second strike against these two alleged survivors of the boat strike in September. Who ordered it? Whether that was murder, whether that was a war crime, we saw Hegseth, who is the War Department secretary at the cabinet meeting earlier this week, say that, you know, he was watching it and then he left the second strike. He's not sure it was on fire. Now the story seems to be that in the last couple of days that this was part of an overall operation, and it is not uncommon to go back and strike again. Lots of different versions. Can you help sort us out, and especially from a legal perspective, tell us what's going on?
The most important thing from a legal perspective is what was the context in which these attacks were happening at all. Is the U.S. military deployed in an armed conflict where hostilities are ongoing and we're facing an armed enemy requiring military force in response to the threat? The answer to all of those points is no. I'm very happy that finally scrutiny is coming to these attacks, because every killing since September 2nd in this context has been unlawful. That we are not at war with any sovereign state. We are using military force in a situation where there are no hostilities at all. These non-state actors are not engaged in actual fighting of a kinetic kind that can trigger the application of the Geneva Conventions, the war fighting laws. So there is no armed conflict. That means any intentional killing, not following law enforcement rules for the use of lethal force, is an unlawful killing. It is a crime. Even within the president's own unusual casting characterization of what he would like us to think is going on, that he thinks he's just pursuing an armed conflict against non-state actors who are terrorists of some kind, he calls them narco-terrorists, that even in that context, you cannot kill people who are not members of the armed forces of a sovereign state unless they're directly participating in hostilities at the time. And again, I say there are no hostilities. But even if there were hostilities, even if any of these boats actually shot back at the U.S. Military forces that are in the region, you would never kill people who are in the water. That violates so many different principles of international law. It violates the basic principles with response to shipwrecks. There are principles in the Geneva Conventions that say someone who is disabled, who is defenseless, who's outside the combat, you do not kill them. You can detain them, You can rescue them and bring them to your place of detention, but you cannot kill them. So regardless of the only explanation I've heard is that Admiral Bradley, who gave the order for the second strike in the September 2nd case, he believed that he saw on the drone surveillance footage that one of the individuals in the water was somehow able to get on a communication device. Seems very unlikely. But we heard from Secretary of State Rubio that this particular boat was not heading toward the United States. It had turned around and was heading back to Venezuela. So many things wrong with this scenario. Starting from the very beginning, there's no armed conflict in the Caribbean.
Professor, can you help us unpack this a little bit more with respect to the whole narco-terrorist justification that has been given? You know, you've profiled this as an unlawful killing. Walk us through this a little bit more with respect to the international law standards requiring the imminent threat and the justification that's been given for having taken this action.
After the Second World War, the world came together and made it very clear that force was to be prohibited, military force, armed conflict, after two horrendous world wars in one century. So we came together, we drafted the UN Charter. It is very clear that the resort to military force is prohibited. There are two express exceptions in the Charter, one for self-defense, that's the one that allegedly is at play here, and one if the Security Council authorizes the force. The Security Council has not authorized this force, so is it a case of self-defense? After 9/11, Security Council came together and said that the attack on 9/11 was the kind of armed attack that's mentioned specifically in the UN Charter. Article 51 sets the conditions for lawful resort to force and self-defense. It says if an armed attack occurs. So the U.S. and U.K. went to war in Afghanistan, sovereign state, which we alleged had responsibility for the 9/11 attacks. There were hostilities there. We followed the Geneva Conventions, the additional protocol. That was an international armed conflict. There, basically, we see a lot of compliance with international law in that conflict. We could get into more detail, but let's move on. After that, it becomes quite questionable. Ongoing attacks against persons that are somehow associated with Al-Qaeda, the group that actually attacked in the U.S. on 9/11, it becomes more and more controversial. And by 2024, the last year of the Biden administration, it was only the U.S. and Israel that were carrying out strikes on non-state actor groups who were alleged to be terrorists. But it is that paradigm that President Biden was still pursuing, that President Trump is trying to build on, but in a quite different, distinctive context. There's never been an attack on the United States by these individuals he's targeting. He's tried to build up drug trafficking and the deaths that result from people who purchase illicit drugs and ingest them in their systems as being somehow the kind of armed attack that we experienced on 9/11 in this country. You see the problem. There's just a complete disassociation. I understand that it would, the one thing that keeps occurring to me though, is if our members of armed forces have heard for almost 25 years that they can go after terrorists with military force, they're not putting together the whole history leading up to the kinds of terrorists that the Biden, the first Trump administration, Obama, Bush were targeting. They're saying the president is telling us we should continue to target terrorists. So this is really not as much a problem for our members of our armed forces as for the president in terms of wanting to use military force against people the president is designating terrorists. The president knows, he's got to know, his advisors should be telling him that this is in clear violation of international law. But even if our members of our armed forces are understanding that they can go after these terrorists, the people involved in the boat attacks don't have any of the indicia of those fighters that we've been surveilling with drones and so forth in Somalia or Pakistan and other places. They are inevitably carrying weapons. They're in formation. They have been known to carry out actual strikes using violence to gain territory, to settle scores. There is some link to using offensive lethal force. Yeah. People who are selling drugs don't want to kill anybody. They want to get rich. So the president and his advisors have really put the members of our armed forces in a terrible situation by telling them that they can use military force to fight a non-war. But our members of the armed forces should know better than to carry out and follow an order in which they're killing people who have no indication that they're using lethal force offensively. And even more, they should, every one of them should know you do not kill someone who's completely defenseless in the water.
And Trump has,
whether they've reached for a cell phone.
Right. And Trump has said that each boat represents, you know, 25,000 Americans that are dying from these drugs. I'm not sure where he's getting that info. But by Trump's logic, Professor, couldn't you, once these alleged criminals reach shore, and let's say they took the drugs and they were driving through the streets of Miami in an Escalade, by Trump's logic, you could blow up that Escalade on land, right? I mean, without any due process, without any representation, without any trial, without all of the things that we take for granted when you stop someone on the streets, why is that different on sea?
That's why every international lawyer I know outside the government, many, many retired JAG officers, every reputable professor of international law who teaches in this area, we've all come out uniformly saying these attacks are unlawful. Because the logic is, right, you can kill anyone, anywhere. These are the kinds of killings that the former president of the Philippines, Duterte, was carrying out. He was just killing people. Yes, we all agree. Illicit drugs are a terrible scourge. But we also know two things. You do not promote the rule of law, legality, law and order by violating the law. It's a contradiction in terms, it's a contradiction in practice. You only promote lawlessness. We have the methods inside this country and outside. You go after people dealing in illicit drugs using law enforcement methods, using careful cooperation with countries. You go after, on a two-pronged approach, you go after the causes. Why would anyone want to leave their family and be involved in this kind of terrible business unless they were desperate? So give people a lawful alternative, but also use your excellent law enforcement mechanisms. Use your good relationships with other countries, cooperation. That's how we're going to have to deal with most of the challenges that we're facing in this world. This easy resort to military force is dramatic, but it has not solved either the problem of terrorism or the problem it's making, in my view, our chances of having good cooperative relationships with lots of countries around the world very, very difficult, because countries work on the basis of international law. That's what they understand. That's their language. When they make an agreement to cooperate on law enforcement, they expect countries to commit, to follow up, and believe in and act on their promises, on their treaty promises. And President Trump is really sending out the message, you cannot trust the U.S. We'll designate who we want for summary execution and go forward with it. This is not the basis for a flourishing world society.
Professor Mary Ellen O'Connell, thank you so much. We're going to have to leave it there. Great conversation. We really appreciate it.
I appreciate the questions.
You are listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face-Off. Dina is a partner at McDermott, Will & Emery and focuses her practice on domestic and international trademark and copyright law, as well as domain name, internet, social media, advertising, and unfair competition law. Tina has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubbell and being selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications, including Chambers & Partners and World Trademark Review. Tina is also the recipient of the Anti-Defamation League's Women of Achievement Award and has been recognized by Crain's Chicago Business as one of Chicago's most influential minority lawyers. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is an author, columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host, and she frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current issues and trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. McDermott, Will & Emery is an integrated international law firm. McDermott has an uncompromising commitment to legal excellence, extraordinary client service and a high-performance culture. It is committed to helping clients achieve stellar legal and business results today and well into the future. To contact Tina and to learn more about McDermott Will & Emery, visit MWE.com.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off with Rich Lenkoff and Tina Martini. I'm Ryan Burrow. The Pentagon is investigating Democratic Senator Mark Kelly of Arizona after he urged American troops in a video to defy illegal orders. Those comments have brought criticism from the White House as well as some legal experts. So let's bring in our own expert on the topic. Professor Todd Huntley is the director of the National Security Law Program and a lecturer in law at Georgetown University Law Center. He comes to Georgetown after serving more than 20 years on active duty in the U.S. Navy as a judge advocate general. Professor, thanks so much for jumping on with us.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thanks for appearing. Thanks also for your service, of course. We really appreciate it. Professor, I'm old enough to remember about a week ago, when Democrats were struggling to find examples of crimes that they were advising in this video that members of the military should avoid. Now, of course, we know that one example of a possible crime could be, killing survivors in the water after a boat strike, right? So that's perhaps one example, but we'll get to that in a second. You, of course, are actually a former prosecutor, as Ryan mentioned, and
yes.
You prosecuted people under the UCMJ. How do you look at this whole discussion about whether to prosecute Mark Kelly and whether that would pass muster?
I can't believe anybody would take it seriously that this should be brought to a court martial. I mean, if I had been a prosecutor and somebody had brought it to me and asked for my recommendation, I would have said, no way.
Could you also explain, by the way, how a sitting senator who is a former member of the military could face a court martial? That doesn't seem like that doesn't make a lot of sense if you're not currently in the military.
Yeah, so the Uniform Code of Military Justice actually gives jurisdiction over retired military members to the military. It's very rare. Before a retired military member is prosecuted, you have to get permission from the service secretary. So they'd have to go to the Secretary of the Navy in this case and get permission. And then the individual can be prosecuted at a court-martial. I prosecuted a guy who had been retired for 16 years and had been sexually assaulting his daughter in Okinawa. And we got permission because no one else had jurisdiction to try the case.
So is there all, I mean, I'm sorry, Tina's going to want to jump in, but does that last forever? I mean, is that statute? There's no statute of limitations as long as you're ex-military.
There's no statute of limitations on having jurisdiction over you.
Right,
there certainly are statutes of limitations on certain crimes.
Got it.
So, Professor, how much does it matter legally that the statements or conduct being examined occurred while Kelly was acting as a civilian rather than in a military capacity? I mean, it sounds like there's jurisdiction here, but walk us through the legal implications.
Right. No, you're right. Most of the time, if there were offenses that were committed solely after the individual left active duty while they were retired, again, that would be one reason not to bring it to a court martial. You know, they would turn it over to some state official or perhaps federal civilian officials to prosecute if it was a crime in those jurisdictions.
So what is the theory here exactly? Obviously, again, we know that Mark Kelly participated in this video. He's been called part of the Seditious Six, right? That they had the temerity to advise military what they already know and what should be painfully obvious is don't follow unlawful orders, right? That's kind of an obvious thing. But what would be the crime involved here? What would you be investigating? And how, I mean, you said it would be, no prosecutor would take it. How difficult would that be to prove?
It would be very difficult. And for one thing, the senators and representatives have immunity from statements made right under the debates clause of the Constitution. I'm no expert, so I don't know how that would apply. But in this case, the what was said does not cross the line into any type of criminal conduct. The primary statute being Title 18, I believe, Section 2384, which makes it a federal crime to do anything to undermine the morale of the military. And there's several other requirements there, but this does not come close. And in fact, I think a video's surfaced just in the last couple of days of Secretary Hegseth back in 2016 saying almost exactly the same thing.
What is, based on your prosecutorial experience, I mean, it sounds like this case is unlikely to go anywhere, but like from an evidentiary burden standpoint, what does that even look like in a case like this, especially knowing what we know right now?
Well, I guess, you know, for a prosecutor who were to bring this case, well, I guess the evidence is playing the video. You know, and other than that, you know, perhaps they would bring in some sort of evidence of the effect it might have on the military, you know, some military member to testify. But again, it doesn't come close to meeting the elements in that statute or in, you know, in a statute in the Uniform Code of Military Justice.
We don't deal too much on this show. We've been running now for almost 11 years with the UCMJ. But do the standards, does the burden of proof differ from those in regular court? In other words, do either active or former members of the military, do they have to abide by higher standards when it comes to First Amendment protections, for example, than ordinary citizens? I imagine that there are different standards, right?
There are. I mean, the standards and the burdens, those are all the same. I mean, the military rules of evidence are modeled on the federal rules of evidence. They track almost exactly. But when it comes to possible restrictions or consequences for First Amendment activity, those are different. There are different standards. So something that a civilian might, you know, be perfectly free to say might constitute contemptuous words toward a public official and could be prosecuted, or somebody could be prosecuted perhaps for an offense that undermines good order and discipline in the military based on what they've been saying. And that certainly doesn't apply in the civilian sector.
Todd, you know, we just got done talking about, you know, whether Pete Hegseth committed a war crime, whether he committed murder. Would a attack on the survivors of the strike, now that we're talking about in that situation, would that be considered a crime under the UCMJ? And would that be the kind of illegal order that members of the military would have discretion to not follow?
Well, you know, what orders are unlawful in the military, it gets pretty complex. Most orders or all orders are presumed to be lawful, and only those orders that are patently unlawful are ones that service members are, you know, must disobey. But in this case, the example in the Department of Defense Law of War Manual of an unlawful order is shooting survivors of a shipwreck.
Wow. That's literally the textbook definition.
Yes. Now, of course, you know, the other facts could, you know, come in and complicate the matter. Are we in a non-international armed conflict? Are they still on the boat and in the fight? Are they really shipwrecked and helpless in the water? And those are all the things that I think, you know, on the Hill today, hopefully they got to see when they reviewed that video.
And what about the chain of command? So, you know, we know that Hegseth and Trump have basically thrown Admiral Bradley under the bus, right? I mean, it went from Hegseth ordering the let's kill them all, allegedly, we don't know, to, oh, it was Bradley who had operational control, but we support him. We support his decision. But even if it was Bradley who made the call to kill these two, if that's what happened, does the Secretary of War, is he the ultimate, you know, is he responsible? Just playing it out, if Bradley was charged with a war crime or murder, could Hegseth be brought in as part of a conspiracy kind of thing? That's probably not the right terms, but you know what I'm getting at.
Right. I mean, possibly, but ultimately he is the one responsible.
Right.
Something else that hopefully Congress gets to look at is the execution order that approved, you know, all of these operations as well as the rules of engagement. And that would show us who actually has the authority to engage a target. And there have been reports that that authority has been withheld to the Secretary of Defense himself. Now, he may have delegated it, but again, that order originates with him.
So, Professor, last question. Do you see this as an isolated case, or do you think that this is a foreshadowing of similar things to come?
You know, yeah, it depends on how long this operation, I think they're calling it Southern Spear, goes on. Because, Yeah, at least in my opinion, the entire operation, the targeting of any of the boats is unlawful. We just aren't in an armed conflict with these drug cartels. And so any strike would be unlawful in that case. But if this continues to happen, you're going to have survivors that are in the water who try to get back on boats. So, you know, again, it's likely to happen again unless they've changed the rules of engagement. Because remember, just a few weeks after this strike on September 2nd, there were two other survivors in the Eastern Pacific that were picked up and returned to Colombia and Ecuador. So why did they return them in that case?
Professor, and why did Trump pardon a narco-terrorist and the former president of Honduras? That's a different situation. We have one more minute. I just want to ask you, maybe explain for our listeners or viewers what I think are two, you know, straightforward issues. Number one, why is it important? You mentioned that military, generally, the default is follow orders. Why is it important for the military to follow orders and not take it upon themselves to decide whether this is a survivor that they should, you know, kill or not, whether they're, you know, violating crimes, number one. Number two, why is it so important that, to your point, the manual says don't kill survivors? I mean, the reason is because you don't want that to happen to Americans, right?
Exactly. And, you know, I like to think that we Americans are the good guys, even during times of armed conflict. And certainly, you know, when we're operating with international partners, they expect us to abide by international law. It's already been reported that I think the UK, Colombia, and the Netherlands have stopped sharing intelligence on counter-drug operations in the Caribbean. So, you know, we're going to lose an important access to classified information. But as to the importance of following orders, you know, people's lives depend on split-second decisions and actions during armed conflict. And if you have soldiers second-guessing orders that are given on a routine basis, lives are going to be lost. And so you need the standard to be that orders are lawful. But you also need to have the training and you know, strong leadership to prevent those orders from crossing the line into unlawful territory.
Professor Todd Hundley, thank you so much for coming on with us.
Thank you.
Well, since 1949, it's been illegal to sell comic books to children in Sacramento, California. That was till now, and California's capital city is going all in on the illustrated books now. Let's get a deep dive on that with Jeff Trexler, Interim Director of Comic Book Legal Defense Fund. Jeff, thank you so much for coming on Legal Face-Off.
Thanks for having me. Wonderful show. Great to see you.
We appreciate it. We get everyone here on Legal Face-Off. This is a first for us dealing with this subject, but, you know, really interesting topic. Talk to us about this ordinance that, as Ryan mentioned, is decades old in California that bans comic book sales to minors. Why would there be such a ban, and does that pass constitutional muster?
Yeah. Back in the 1930s and 40s, when comic book just took off, seemingly out of nowhere, you know, Superman was published, and all of a sudden comics were selling millions of copies a month. And you would go down to a newsstand, you know, kids, there used to be these things called newsstands where you'd buy magazines and stuff. And comics were just taking over sort of the visual landscape of the United States. And as you know, in the United States, we tend to respond rationally when something's new and different. And the way we do it is just to assume that it is harming children. It's bad for kids. It's going to destroy their literacy. It's going to corrupt their morals. It's happened with radio, television, movies, and comics were no different. Back in the 1940s, particularly late 40s and early 50s, there were these campaigns nationwide to ban comics, to make them illegal to sell to children, because comics were, they said they were not just destroying literacy, but they were causing kids to be juvenile delinquents. Which is why in this Sacramento ordinance, they particularly target crime comics, because the theory was that kids were reading crime comics and they weren't just learning how to commit crimes, but it was making them more inclined to do them. So it became sort of comics as the cause of juvenile delinquency panic.
Well, what's the problem with that theory that comic books cause juvenile delinquency, for lack of a better term?
Well, for one thing, comics really don't cause juvenile delinquency is the big issue. They were some legitimate concerns just in terms of, you know, media do affect how people sort of like when people talk about social media today and there's connections between excessive social media use and depression and this sort of thing. You know, whenever there is a new medium, medium do shape us, like Marshall McLuhan said, with the medium is the message. But the notion that there was this linear link between comics and crime was really overblowing the nature of those effects. And banning comics was the worst thing you could do. We really were in a shift in how we communicate from all text to a fusion of text and image. And I think what people lost in the mix back then was the way that comics were contributing to a new form of literacy, an expanded type of literacy, where people had to learn how to engage images as well as words in a more intelligent fashion. Banning kept people from doing that.
Jeff, talk to us about Texas, because their House Bill 900 attempted to, again, restrict access to certain books and graphic novels in schools. You call that a momentous ruling. Talk to us about why that was so significant.
Yeah, we're in the midst of another panic. Comics have gone from newsstands on the corner and grocery stores and drugstores to something that is, then we had comic shops. They were new in Texas and across the United States in many ways as a mass phenomenon in the 1990s. And there was a wave of arrests in the 1980s and 90s of comic shop managers and owners for selling books that were deemed to be offensive or obscene. And now people realize that graphic novels and manga, you can find them in schools. And when parents started realizing that graphic novels and manga were in school libraries and school classrooms, we had another kind of panic. Texas has been in many ways kind of the center of it. It's a place that where the books that you buy in schools and in libraries can affect the market for those books nationwide. And in Texas, what they were doing was not so much banning them as requiring that any book that was going to be in schools, and graphic novels really were the main target for this, had to be rated by the distributor. And the ratings were not PG, R, that sort of thing, but they were sexually explicit and sexually relevant. So basically, your books had to have this big, blaring sex on them if they were going to be sold in a school, which would have ended up basically any book with any kind of mature theme from, you know, Shakespeare on up was all of a sudden going to be something that you wouldn't want to have in your school library or your school classroom. So when the court decided that that was constitutionally problematic, that that was really unconstitutional, it was what's called compelled speech, and also the standard itself was void for vagueness, it was sending a message nationwide that you can't just simply say that it's that a concern for kids enables you to do anything you want when it comes to regulating access to First Amendment protected material. Now, fortunately, the courts have for decades, and it really picked up in the 60s and 70s, fought back against these kind of statutes. In fact, even in California, there was a Supreme Court case that said statutes, they were focusing on the Los Angeles statute, but you could apply it to statutes such as the one in Sacramento were unconstitutional. They were taking illegal action against First Amendment protected material. But those statutes in many places still were on the books. And as we've seen with the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund, people don't hesitate to use unconstitutional statutes even now if they haven't been repealed. So, and fighting those takes a lot of time and money and expense. So the Texas thing was momentous, saying you can't just say we're doing this for the children and then anything goes regardless of whether it's constitutional.
So how do the courts distinguish, and also what is your organization's policy on the difference between legitimate laws that are meant to protect children and the exercise of free expression under the Constitution? I mean, it seems to me that that's such a slippery slope, and it's so subjective that you have to, you know, if it's close, you have to weigh in favor of freedom of expression. But how do courts distinguish that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of it is vague, and there are statutes that have been on the books that have kind of worked for decades because communities were, through librarians and teachers and collaboration with parents and school boards, they were taking a very measured approach to them, thinking about the educational significance of the books and the that even though it may have some adult themes or some or themes about violence and that sort of thing, that some people might object to just on principle for anything that has those sorts of themes, that they were recognized that these books had some sort of educational content. They were valuable for kids. Graphic novels were useful for kids. Manga was useful for kids. And things just went because it was things went well. Because when books were removed, it was very rare and for very particular reasons, often something that you could look at and say, yeah, there's sort of a social consensus that maybe we shouldn't be giving Penthouse to, you know, kindergartners or something like that. But more recently, particularly since the pandemic, there has been this scare, and it's really been much of it has been focused on graphic novels and manga, that these books themselves are grooming children. They're bad for children. We're even seeing some libraries and schools that are taking graphic novels and saying kids can't access them at all. Graphic novels are too dangerous for kids, and they should be put behind the circulation desk, and you have to have an adult check them out or an adult with a child to have a child have access to them at all. And I think when things get to that level of extreme, you're sending a bad message to kids. You're sending a bad message about your community. And I think you're keeping people from accessing a medium that's incredibly useful in this age where really, if you get on the internet, you work on, you know, anything you do right now is in a diffusion of word and image. So if you keep kids from accessing that early, it's going to hurt their educational development.
Jeff, you know, Ryan might be too young to remember this, but as an avid comic book reader growing up, I was always like fascinated and also alternately petrified by that seal, the Comics Code Authority. There was such a thing. No one knew what it meant, but maybe this was part of this was maybe an early, version of what you're talking about, the Comics Code Authority.
Yeah, very much so. You know, the United States Supreme Court really didn't, in terms of what we now understand things, the United States Supreme Court it wasn't until the 1960s and 1970s when it was very clear that unless a work was obscene, states and the federal government couldn't regulate it. So in the 1940s and 1950s, there was a lot of fear that states and the federal government were going to make comics illegal in the United States. In fact, there were United States Senate hearings here in New York City, where I am now, in downtown New York, whether comics caused juvenile delinquency. And there was a sense that maybe, just maybe, the same sort of ordinance we have in Sacramento could become the law of the land, sort of banning horror comics and crime comics, maybe even all comics nationwide. So to protect themselves against this kind of movement by state and federal legislators, the comics industry came together and they created what's just called the Comics Code. It's a code for self-regulation. And it was, by modern standards, pretty simplistic. Good had to prevail over evil. You couldn't have any depiction of drugs at all. You couldn't glorify crime. You couldn't raise any questions about people in position of trust or authority in this social order. Of course, a lot of restrictions on the depiction of women and sex. It was a pretty, I guess you could say, it was a very sort of childlike kind of approach to storytelling, which is why if you look at comics after the code, they were very, almost like the Batman TV show. It was really just sort of good versus evil and not a lot of the nuance that you find in comics today. So it is a matter of concern, I think, for a lot of people that we have a lot of pressure on the industry to enact kind of a new comics code now to take out any kind of attempt for sophisticated storytelling and replace it with something that is so anodyne, so simplistic, so childlike, in the five or six year old sort of approach, a sense of the term, that they lose any value for both the comics lose any value for both kids and adults.
Jeff, last question: where does the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund stand on the very important issue of sea monkeys, and how do we bring back sea monkeys?
Oh, sea monkeys! Oh, very good question.
At the back of every comic book, there used to be an ad you could send away and get sea monkeys. I never got to sea monkeys. I got something, but they didn't grow into sea monkeys.
Brine shrimp, they were called. In fact, I ordered them as well as a lover of comics back when I was a kid. And that's a good question. You know, one of the things we've lost, back when comics were this People were buying, you know, individual comic books in the millions, and you could have a Sea Monkey ad reach millions. There are lots of ads in comics. There was a huge market for this sort of thing. There were Brine Shrimp, or sorry, Sea Monkey sales, and X-ray specs, and fart cushions, and all this sort of stuff. There's a big market for. They even used to sell dresses and this sort of thing in romance comics and Mary Marvel comics and things like that. We've lost that. I don't know about the animal care codes and what they would do for brine sales of brine shrimp nowadays. I think the one thing that maybe you felt this too, but when you saw those ads, the brine shrimp, they were wearing little crowns.
Yes.
And they had little families and they would watch TV. Yeah. They didn't do that. They were just these little floaty specks. and maybe truth in advertising laws would get sea monkeys in the end.
Yeah, that and, you know, sending in countless pennies for Columbia House Records under 75 different pseudonyms to build up my my collection. But thank you so much. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, I want to point out, you've got a lot of books behind you, but not comic books. Is it safe to say that the interim director of Comic Book Legal Defense Fund has some comic books under lock and key in your possession?
I have plenty. I'm actually speaking in somebody else's office right now. I'm a guest in someone's office today. But if you were in my home office, you would see the complete bound volumes of EC Comics. You would see a lot of Batman, Superman. You would see Mouse, you know, which has been censored. Yeah. You would see a lot of books. So I just happen not to be in that office today, but I promise
you,
if you ever have me back again, I'll be in that office with those books.
Are you in the process of collecting or selling at this point?
At this point, I'm really in the process of just a lot of reading. So I've had a collection. I've like many people, sold them way too young. So no $9 million Supermans in my collection, but I do have bound volumes of a lot of comics that I love to read.
Jeff Trexler, thank you so much for joining us on Legal Face Off.
Rich Lenkoff is an attorney with Downey & Lenkoff, a firm with offices in Illinois, Indiana, and Wisconsin. Rich is consistently recognized by clients like McDonald's, Target, Macy's, Wendy's, and the Chicago Bears for his zealous advocacy and outstanding litigation results. Rich's many accolades include being named as an Illinois Super Lawyer from 2015 to present and leading lawyer from 2012 to present. These are designations given to less than 5% of Illinois attorneys. Rich is also an active member of his community, serving on the Legal Prep Charter Academy Advisory Board and the Northern Illinois University College of Law Board of Visitors. Rich is also a producer with credits including 85, The Greatest Team in Football History, starring Barack Obama, Bill Murray, and Mike Ditka. Renegades, a Caesar's Palace production starring Terrell Owens, Jose Canseco, and Jim McMahon, Rock of Ages, and Elvis Presley's Heartbreak Hotel in concert. In addition to hosting WGN's Legal Face-Off since 2014, Rich serves as a legal analyst for a variety of media outlets. Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service litigation firm practicing general liability, workers' compensation, professional malpractice, and intellectual property, among other practice areas. For more information about Rich and Downey & Lenkoff, please visit dl-firm.com.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off on WGN, and it's time for the Legal Grab Bag. Gabe Roth, the executive director of Fix the Court, is back with us and is strong as always background game and looking sharp as always. And of course, we have Todd Beresford, senior counsel director of workers' compensation with the Cleveland Clinic. He's also a board member with Kids Chance of Ohio. Todd and Gabe, thanks so much for coming on with us.
Thanks for having us.
Great to be here.
All right. So a swing and a miss for the Trump administration in their effort to install a loyalist to be the top federal prosecutor in New Jersey. The president's pick was DQ'd by a panel of appeals court judges. Tina kicks us off with Trump Watch this week.
Now, Ryan, so this happened earlier this week. The appeals court judges upheld the disqualification of Alina Habba as the top federal prosecutor in New Jersey. It was a 32-page opinion, and the judge writing the opinion said in several memorable quotes that it's apparent that the current administration has been frustrated by some of the legal and political barriers to getting its appointees in place. So this is actually just one chess piece and on the bigger board, where there have been a number of Trump administration attempts to put various folks in the U.S. attorney spots without Senate confirmation. There are defendants challenging the authority of the U.S. attorneys in California and Nevada as well, where the judges have determined that the Trump-picked prosecutors are serving unlawfully, as well as in New York. And last week, a judge DQ'd the top federal prosecutor, Lindsey Halligan, in the Eastern District of Virginia, and actually tossed the charges brought against former FBI Director James Comey and New York Attorney General Letitia James. Today, as a matter of fact, I think a judge is set to hear oral arguments in a case challenging the authority of a Trump pick to lead the Northern District of New York. So, Rich, these are, I would call them swings and a few misses in this situation.
I mean, they don't care. Trump doesn't care, right? He'll keep doing the stuff. We know that from covering Trump on this show now for 7 or 8 years, that this is his tactic, right? He will try the most outrageous legal stunt, and he will use that for as long as he can until a court, rightfully in this case, as in many cases, finds that it is unconstitutional or illegal. And then he'll just do it again, or he'll appeal, or he'll call the judges crooked or whatever, right? But, you know, your earlier point about the throwing out the Comey case, like, ironically, they actually had a pretty good case against Comey. Gabe, like, of all the cases to throw, you know, there was a lot of, like, nonsensical cases brought. But by all accounts, Comey was probably almost a slam dunk. And they got and they threw that one out because of his move here. So it's kind of like karma coming back, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right. There have been so many of these attempts at appointments that are clearly not lawful. And like you said, it's going to continue happening. The Comey case, yes, there is an argument to be made that he lied to Congress and could be held in contempt and liable for that. But the idea that you have it's not just in, deep blue states. It's really all over the country that you've got these individuals that Trump these districts that Trump can't find anybody to do his bidding except the most outrageous lawyer there. You would think that in a place like the Eastern District of Virginia, home to the son of Sam Alito, he could find somebody that would be able to do his job. But the fact that he had to find someone unqualified just goes to show you that, you know, it's just he's going to keep pushing the envelope. And, these cases are just a way to keep the quote unquote, the bad guys, the resistance movement that he hates in the news and to make him look strong.
Yeah, I mean, Todd, I don't know whether you support Trump or not. It's great if you do, because I actually want someone to come on or just tell me how you justify the appointment of these people who are just plain unqualified. I don't know how else to say it, but they're unqualified. Their only qualification for being the top prosecutor in some of the busiest offices in the United States are that they're loyal to Trump, that they wore Trump is always right hats, right? I mean, Lindsey Halligan, like, she never tried a case. She was an insurance lawyer, and she effed up the entire grand jury presentation that probably a 1L would understand how to do. So, like, I don't know. It would seem that at some point, the DOJ and Trump would learn that you're not helping your case by putting in unqualified people.
I agree 100%, Rich. Frankly, I've only practiced administrative law, and I think I have as much qualifications as 3/4 of these U.S. attorneys who have been appointed the last 6 or 8 months. And it's one thing I find frustrating is it's whichever administration changes immediately. Within a month or two, we lose so many good U.S. attorneys across the country because they're going to get fired by the new administration every time. And unfortunately, it's the way it's set up. But I wish we could do something about it to keep some of these quality U.S. attorneys who've really gained a lot of experience and might be in the middle of a high profile case when they're suddenly axed just because of who they were appointed. So it's something I don't think there's a good fix for. But certainly Trump is going to, he's definitely tested a lot of boundaries, is going to keep pushing. And I have a feeling he's going to keep reappointing some of these. I looked at one of the statutes today on the vacancies, and frankly, it is kind of, I think, ambiguous. And I think he's got some wild arguments that by the plain meaning or plain writing of the statute, may have some, he may be able to reappoint some of these people again. So I think we're going to continue, you know, seeing this until it ultimately reaches the Supreme Court. And who knows what they're going to do these days either with some of his cases.
You're right. Some of the language is ambiguous, but like, you know what's not ambiguous? Like checks and balances. The idea that you should have to
exactly.
Congress to appoint these important people. That's a basic fundamental principle of this democracy. And Trump gives zero F's about that.
All right. So from New Jersey, we head to Utah, where a father is charged with torturing and abusing his children by forcing them onto a snowy hike. He will not be released from jail until at least December 8th. Rich, he says he's not going to harm his children, but prosecutors disagree.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really interesting story. The reason we picked Tina was because, you know, where's the line between pushing your children, right, and making them sort of or try to mold them to be a little tougher? We all know that kids today, as an old man, I'm speaking, are, you know, soft and they are all about their algorithm and all this stuff and they're not outdoors as much. What's the, you know, line between pushing your kids to tough it out, as this father allegedly said, and torture? I mean, in this case, you know, it seems like it's a strong case. The details are that this father, Micah Smith, 31 years old from Utah, they went out in October. They went on a incredibly strenuous hike, right? One that was probably not, you know, good for three children their age. Weather got bad, night fell, and they became stranded several thousand feet up. And there was snow and rain and hail and cold. And one of the children fell, hit his head, stopped breathing. If you see the picture, like there's all sorts of tubes coming out of it. Really bad. Prosecutors said, not only do we have a strong case, but hard no on letting him out of jail. So, you know, prosecutors know their evidence pretty well. Is this a case of prosecutor of them being too aggressive, or is this the right charge? Does this send a message to other parents that there's a line that this person stepped over?
You did a great job teeing it up, Rich. I do think there's a lot of layers to this. I think part of it may be where this case is. I think it's also the egregious nature. I think the mother was involved, the mother of the children. And I think, you know, there were several flags raised, so to speak, during this whole episode where he could have aborted the mission of taking these kids out where he did, where the weather was inclement, it was extremely cold. And I do think that part of this is to try to deter other similar acts by parents of pushing their kids too far. I think this was pretty egregious. I mean, especially when you have children ending up hospitalized and, you know, not breathing, it's clear that, you know, at best, he didn't know the proper boundaries. And at worst, he walked into this with, I mean, like they said, he tortured them. And at worst, I think that's what happened here. But clearly, terrible, terrible judgment.
Yeah, I mean, I think mitigating or I guess aggravating this, Todd, from the prosecutor's perspective and the police was his behavior. You know, they consider it odd. He wasn't really concerned about the kids so much. We've covered this kind of same thing many times, right? When it comes to holding parents responsible for school shootings, right? That's been a recent trend of prosecuting and successfully putting people in jail whose kids are involved in school shootings. We cover extensively. We all see news of, you know, kids left in cars and parents being charged with murder for that. So I think there is a trend to more aggressively prosecute parents who are moving beyond, to Tina's point, just bad judgment to actually engaging in reckless or negligent behavior that results in serious harm.
Yeah, I think it's important to note, too. I don't think you said the kids' ages. I believe there were 8, 4, and 2. So these were not older teenage kids he was taking on this really extensive hike. These were young children. And I think it was noted, too, they were barely clothed. You know, it's snowing. There's a middle of a storm and they had very little clothing on. So there was a lot of I call parental negligence going on there to begin with, to be out in that type of weather with those type of kids. But something else I saw, too, with regard to the story that after this incident, he was also charged with trespass, I think, at the hospital. He went in and he interfered with his children's care, and actually was charged with tampering with the medical equipment that his children were on too. So, I think, Tina or somebody mentioned they had some concerns about him, his behavior. And certainly, you know, I think there is definite evidence that he would be a danger to his children if he's let out, at least for the time being, until they get things sorted out. So I 100% agree with the judge in this case.
Yeah, and Gabe, you know, I think prosecutors will admit always that there is an element of, you know, setting an example. But it sounds like, to Todd's point, in this case, it's probably about 80% because of this guy's behavior, and maybe the rest is trying to send a message to other parents.
It's okay to send a message here. I mean, I think parents should already have internalized the message that you don't take a toddler, two toddlers and a grade school kid out in a freaking snowstorm in high elevation. I'm thinking about the hikes that I do with my 4-year-old, and they're never more than half a mile on flat land during a beautiful sunny day. Otherwise, I mean, can you just imagine the tantrums? I mean, like, any parent would just want to turn around and go back, or at least most sane parents would want to turn around and go back when the 2 and 4-year-olds start vigorously crying during such a ordeal. But yeah, I'm fine with setting an example. I think it's clearly children endangerment, and it's possibly a mental issue too, because this is just a crazy story, and I don't think the dad has his head screwed on right.
FBI Director Kash Patel visited his girlfriend in Pennsylvania to watch her sing the national anthem at a sporting event. That's sweet, right? But Democrats in the House Judiciary Committee say he used the FBI's Gulfstream passenger jet to do it. And apparently, Tina, that's not allowed.
Oh, Ryan. So the committee Democrats here allege that Patel's use of the Gulfstream jet in connection with what they're terming his date night in Tennessee and an outing with friends in Texas doesn't seem particularly kosher. And they've asked him to respond with travel records, passenger information, and any communication with passengers about the recent flights. The issue here is that, you know, they know about this because these flights were revealed by public flight logs. And of course, as we've talked about many times here on Legal Face Off, the infamous social media posts that always seem to do people in. The reason why this is all an issue here, Rich, is because, you know, there are rules around these things. FBI directors are required by policy to use government aircraft for air travel, regardless of whether or not it's official or personal. This allows them, in the case they're traveling somewhere and need to have the ability to communicate over secure channels, this enables them to be able to do that and to pivot while they're in transit in the event of an emergency. The issue here is that if you have people on the flight with you as an FBI director, or you're doing personal travel as a member of government, you have to reimburse the government at coach fare rates, and you have to reimburse the same type of costs for any family or friends that you take on personal trips. It sounds like this may not have happened, which is why the Democrats' letter has sought to get Patel's travel records. They don't have a formal congressional subpoena power, Rich, so all they can do is request that these get handed over. But obviously, this has gotten a lot of attention in recent days.
Yeah. Well, two simple questions. What was it for? Who else was on the plane? If others were on the plane, then he's in trouble. He violated the rules. I say he's in trouble. He's not in any trouble. Trump doesn't give a crap, and Congress has no power. But in addition to the trip you mentioned, there was many others, right? He went to a hunting resort in D.C. He went from D.C. to a Texas hunting resort in 2025. He went to a few weekends in Vegas. He went to Scotland in the summer. Again, I don't know what, you know, it's certainly possible that there was official business here. Who knows? But they got to release this. They got to be transparent, which we know they won't be. And we saw from Patel's last appearance on Capitol Hill that he, you know, turned the tables and attacked Adam Schiff and attacked everyone he didn't like. So it's all the same nonsense. But Gabe, will anything come of this?
I don't think so. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see, though, if Democrats take charge of the House or the Senate, more likely the House, in 2026. So it would start in January 2027 if they try to subpoena Patel or bring Patel in. But, you know, there's really not going to be any consequences here. We didn't see any consequences for Clarence Thomas flying around on various billionaires' private planes during his tenure. I don't expect any for Kash Patel. And I think that's part of the reason that people want to be part of the Trump administration is to get these perks and to not have to pay for them or be accountable for them. I think that's part of signing up to be part of this corrupt administration.
Rich, you brought this up earlier in the show. President Trump has pledged to pardon former Honduran President Juan Orlando Hernandez after he was sentenced to 45 years in prison for allegedly creating a cocaine superhighway to the U.S.
I mean, you can't, you know, it's like just you can't make this shit up. This, in any other time in history, this story alone would be the biggest scandal of any president's administration. In our current times, this is like nothing. It's just another story that we deal with every day. But yeah, I mean, this is a narco-terrorist, an adjudicated, tried, convicted narco-terrorist, you know, involved with, you know, millions and millions of dollars, millions of dollars of cocaine. You know, convicted of being involved in the cocaine trade. And, you know, for a president that is so concerned about stopping people and killing people for bringing in drugs, he just released, he pardoned a narco-terrorist, not from the Biden administration, not some his own administration prosecuted this guy and convicted him. And when Trump was asked about this, I mean, I watched the question the other day, and he said, "Oh, I don't know who that is." You don't know which narco terrorist you just pardoned, really? You don't know who that is? And when they reminded him, he goes, "Oh, is that the president of Honduras you're talking about?" He said, "Well, you know, he was very bad for Honduras and the people. Allegedly, I guess, you know, he's buddies with someone in the administration who wrote." And the guy wrote a letter to Trump and think, "Oh, we're very similar and we think alike." Oh, that's enough. Okay, forget it. Forget all the people who died from the cocaine that this guy trafficked. That's enough to warrant a presidential pardon. And there's no process. There's no explanation. There's no, let me just use, it's just another example of Trump wielding this pardon power in a way we've never seen before.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just sort of speechless. I mean, because every week that we get on here on Legal Face-Off, there's something that we think is really pushing the boundary of anything that we have talked about in the last show. It doesn't make any sense, Rich, other than there must be something else going on here that is sort of the key behind the pardon that's being granted that we're just not aware of. Either that or he just wants to blow up boats. And it has nothing to do with stopping drugs. It's just he wants to blow up the boats. And so I don't know. There's really not much to say here because there's no way to reconcile this with anything else that's been done.
Yeah, Todd, I mean, this guy was a buddy of El Chapo.
Yeah,
he's walking free.
I can't rectify this with what's going on in Venezuela right now. And the position he's taken on the president down there, Maduro, it just doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. But I think that's the problem with our Constitution, with the article that provides for pardons. It is very, very it allows for pardons for about anything for U.S. for federal crimes other than impeachment. So it can be abused. And I think it has been abused more and more the last I'd say the last three or four administrations. I kind of looked this morning. George W. Bush issued, I think, 200 pardons during his time. Barack Obama was 1,927. Donald Trump was 1,700. Now Joe Biden was in his first term, and Joe Biden was up to 4,245, which I know we could go off on a whole segment about that. But
most of which are his family. But
yeah. So unless there's a constitutional amendment, there's really not much that can be done with these presidential pardons. They can be given at the whim of the president for any reason. And it's I'm worried the precedent that's been set, it's going to get worse and worse in the future.
All right. Luigi Mangione is fighting to bar evidence from his state murder trial. Tina, he was in court in New York this week and actually watched some of the videos of himself getting arrested.
Now, Ryan, so this has been a big week in this case. He returned to court again today. as the hearing in the state murder case entered its third day. So his lawyers are trying to convince the judge that is overseeing the case to prohibit certain types of what really looks to be critical evidence from being included, such as the alleged murder weapon and Mangione's journal. The whole argument behind this is that the evidence was unlawfully seized from his backpack without a warrant during his arrest. And so prosecutors have so far called about six witnesses to make their case that he was lawfully arrested a few days after he allegedly killed United Health's CEO Thompson. The defense attorneys have really focused primarily, Rich, on the 20 minutes between the time the officers confronted Mangione in the McDonald's and arrested him. They argue that his rights were violated because they waited too long to read his Miranda rights. The officer who participated in the arrest told the judge that he was pretty skeptical that the McDonald's tip that they received was even legitimate, but that when he actually showed up and saw Mangione pull his face mask off, that he knew it was him immediately. He engaged in small talk with him for a few minutes, giving the officers who arrived at the scene time to actually enter the restaurant, and then they subsequently put him under arrest. The focus is really on the backpack here, which apparently had been put out on the table during the arrest out of his reach. And the justification for that is that they were concerned about the officer's safety. There were things that he said while he was engaging in small talk that are definitely incriminating. And this is why his attorneys want to move to suppress a lot of this stuff, including these statements, the gun, the notebook, and other items that would clearly have a lot of value during the case, Rich. So it's going to be interesting to see how this continues to unfold. As we've previously covered here, there's obviously a continued fan club that is appearing when he's in court selling T-shirts and giving him support, which is pretty remarkable, but not unexpected, given the social media following he's garnered since the whole killing occurred a year ago.
It's a problem. I mean, you know, I'm gearing up for a trial, a jury trial here in Cook County in a couple of weeks. And, you know, I'm dealing with my exhibits and evidence is important. I mean, that's an obvious statement, but it's a problem that the police effed this up, right? That they did not have the wherewithal, even though this was the most high profile, you know, fugitive in the world at the time. And they knew right away that it was him. Once you know 100% in the officer's words that this is the guy you're looking for, how about stop, let your training kick in and follow procedure so that later in a court hearing a year later, we're not at risk of losing key evidence like the gun and the notebook in which he basically incriminated himself. If that's all out, it seems obvious that this is a slam dunk case. I don't think so, Gabe. If this stuff is out, you're dealing with a video of a hooded perpetrator. I mean, look at the video. It's a guy in a hood pulling the weapon. And then, you know, the rest of the evidence that you put together, it's not a slam dunk, especially when you consider, to Tina's points, the possibility of lunatics being on the jury, absolute lunatics that we see outside the court proposing to him, writing to him. We know that he writes back to all these freaks. These people who are cheering on a guy who killed a CEO in cold blood because they have some problem with insurance. Okay, then it's okay to kill the father of two who's a CEO of an insurance company. There's a possibility that this guy walks because of the combination of shoddy police work and the lunatic factor.
Yeah, that's definitely a possibility.
It takes one lunatic to walk free, right?
Yeah, I hope that's not the case, but that's, you know, we're still a country with unanimous juries, so that's obviously a possibility, and it's it was just a real disappointment learning about what happened in that McDonald's and the fact that protocol wasn't followed by the police. I don't know, you know, what was going through their head in the sense of, you know, like even if they wanted to make small talk or double check that it was him or engage with him or all these different possible excuses. To your earlier point, this was the number one fugitive in the world at the time. Everyone was looking about him. His face was, everyone was trying to find out who it was, where he was. When they finally cornered him, the fact that that protocol wasn't followed, I mean, they had to have known that was going to be to the detriment of this case. Like that's you see a guy that very likely murdered someone in cold blood. It's time to, like you said, for your training to kick in and to make the arrest and follow protocol to be sure that this guy ends up behind bars. And the fact that there's even a chance, a non-zero, an increasingly greater chance that he walks is absolutely frightening. And, we're talking about a lesson with the Utah dad. I mean, make this a lesson for police officers to follow protocol, because like you said, only one lunatic could get this guy to walk.
By the way, speaking of Cash Patel, Todd, I mean, he's boasted about how quickly they found this guy and arrested him, right? Well, not so fast.
No.
Todd, you want to weigh in at all?
Yeah, what's your take on this one?
I want to give a little grace to the officers in this case. There were so many tips going on, and I think as this officer indicated, he was going there not expecting this to truly be the suspect. And he did have a beanie, I think, on a mask at the time. So by the time he took his mask off, it took him some time. He did probably recognize him. But as it was pointed out earlier, it took some time to get some backup there. I'm sure he was thinking, he wanted to make sure that the patrons were safe, and he didn't engage this suspect too much until, the backup arrived. So I understand, again, it's a split second decision. Were some mistakes made? Yes. I think there's a couple different issues. First, the Miranda, whether he should have been given his Miranda warnings right away. But once the lawful arrest was made, some of those statements, I think, have a chance of getting thrown out. But I really don't think the gun and some of that evidence in the backpack are going to get thrown out. Clearly, the arrest was lawful. I think the search, under the search incident to arrest, that is going to stay in, hopefully. But I think some of those statements, I think, are kind of a gray area, and it's going to be up to the judge whether he excludes those or not.
Let's stay in New York, where there's apparently no free meals for influencers. Police held a woman accused of dining at multiple upscale restaurants in New York, then refusing to pay. Rich, she's earned the nickname the Dine and Dash Diva.
Hey Chung, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right, but she is a self-described food influencer. I mean, I follow a ton of these. They are very, very addictive.
Are you a food influencer?
I am not. I'm a water influencer. I have videos of me drinking water.
It does look refreshing.
It is refreshing.
He does it every 30 seconds in case people are watching at home, just so you can see the logo. Yeah.
This woman, went to a bunch of really expensive restaurants, Tina, in New York, including Peter Luger. So it's one of the best steakhouse in the world, probably. A lot of Michelin-level places. And then wasn't paying. And then she offered to post reviews in lieu of payment. And, a lot of influencers have lots of followers and do get free meals as remuneration or in place of, paying the bill. But many restaurants declined, especially after they realized that she was a scam artist and doing this all over town. Thankfully, she got arrested. But hopefully the meals in prison are less Michelin stars than she was enjoying on the lam.
Well, just a couple of observations about this story, Rich. I mean, first of all, the fact that, the notion crossed her mind that this was actually in some way even a minuscule appropriate because she was giving people good reviews and that she's helping their business. That is just shocking to me that there are people who think this way, but we talk about a lot of wacky stuff here on this show, so I guess I shouldn't be too surprised. But then also the sense I got was that there were some restaurants who were like, she wrote us a good review. So, no big deal if she sort of skipped out and didn't pay her bill. So the fact that some people actually who are on the other side of this behavior didn't seem too bothered by it. I don't know. It's it just makes me wonder what this world is coming to. You go to a restaurant, you get food and you should pay for it and then be on your merry way.
Yeah, well, I think what was aggravating also, Todd, as we talked about earlier, you know, she was also like, you know, deadbeat on a rent. I think she owed like 40 grand in unpaid rent. By the way, one of her landlords was Elliot Spitzer, former governor of New York, who left office in shame. But yeah, we got a video of her. This video sponsored by Tums, apparently. While we waited for that video, Todd, she did this like 7 times, ordered foie gras and expensive steaks. You like expensive meals, I know, from having gone out with you. Have you ever dined and dashed in exchange for influencer videos?
No, I don't understand the whole influencer thing. Still baffles me. But I feel we talked about setting an example earlier. I think this woman needs to be set an example of, because I think we should lock her up for 30 years, frankly. My biggest pet peeve is turning on Facebook and seeing these pictures of food. I don't understand it, never will. And I think it should be stopped immediately. But in terms of these influencers, my daughter is down at school in Charleston, and actually dog sits for an influencer, and it still baffles me. She talks about, she just gets stuff in the mail every day, boxes and packages, and my daughter will take pictures that just randomly show up. It's just like every day is like Christmas. And to me, it's amazing. She goes on vacations in Gulf Streams like Cash Patel. She has pictures on Gulf Streams going to tropical islands. And this whole influencer thing is just completely out of control. And I don't understand it, but good for the ones who actually can and benefit from it and make a living off of it. Because I was shocked when I found out this girl actually makes a nice living just Gabe, posting stuff on social media.
Gabe, you cover the Supreme Court. That's your gig.
It is.
Supreme Court gets lots of free stuff. They don't get, you know, they don't get in trouble. Why shouldn't the regular person get some free stuff?
Yeah, the Supreme Court is famous for the millions of gifts that they've reaped over the last few years. However, you know, I have it on good information that most of the times, if not all the times, that the Supreme Court justices eat out at restaurants in D.C. or Maryland or Northern Virginia, they pay for their meals and for the meals of their clerks. I could probably give a few examples here and there, but you know, want to probably keep that a little quiet. You know, they're good patrons, and they're good citizens, at least when they're in within the Beltway. When they leave and go off to hunting trips and fancy all male resorts, maybe that's a different story. But at least within in DC, there's no dining and dashing. And look, Ms. Chung is probably headed to prison, and that's one of the few places in the world you are allowed to dine and dash. So I hope she enjoys it there.
28,000 followers. According to her bio, she is Taiwanese. My bro is a fighter jet pilot. Well, good for her. No plastic surgery, by the way. She's got that in the info. So if you guys
28,000 doesn't warrant a free meal.
No, that's my organization. Fix the Court has that many on Twitter, and we're not influencing anyone on anything. So come on.
Rich, does it get a free slice of pizza at your joint on the north side? Or?
Are you referring to Pizza Amelia, Chicago's newest and favorite pizza restaurant? The answer is no. 28,000 does not warrant in
six, you know, figures. It's got to be at least six figures.
Got to be a million or so.
And last time I checked, no drunken raccoons in the bathroom there. All right. So you stumble on a drunk raccoon passed out in a liquor store bathroom. I want to know a little bit about kind of the lead story up to that. But your first move, do you take a picture? Do you try to pet the raccoon? Do you call the cops, or do you try to sober up real quick?
Yeah, I mean, who among us hasn't dealt with this very scenario many times? But, you know, I think the legal part here, Tina, was that this bandit was drunk. He drank a bunch of the bottles of alcohol in this Ashland, Virginia store and then passed the hell out on the bathroom floor.
Well, at least he passed out on the bathroom floor, which is more than I can say for some humans.
Yes, that's right. And you know, he was picked up by the county animal protection and shelter, and you know, didn't commit more mayhem, I guess, which is the good news. But yeah, you know, this is just a normal Friday for some of us. there he is, the poor.
There he is.
Do we know his name?
I don't think we know this critter's
name. So Tina would pet him, right?
I don't know if I'd pet them. I mean, I had issues with raccoons, like trying to live in my house, and they have some pretty nasty teeth on them. But this guy looks like he's unconscious. So I maybe less of a threat trying to pet him while he's unconscious.
All right. Well, maybe a couple too many shots of Malort for this guy. But let's go around the table here and end our time together. Speaking of raccoons, drunk raccoons, what animal, friends, we'll start with Ryan, not a raccoon, would you least like to encounter on the floor of your bathroom, especially if they're drunk? So besides the drunk raccoon, what critter would you least like to encounter as you visit the bathroom, perhaps at 3 a.m. to do whatever you need to do?
Drunk or not drunk, I'd say an alligator.
Oh, wow. No one wants a gator in the bathroom.
Wait, am I drunk or is the gator drunk?
Todd lives in a part of the world that has all sorts of critters and animals roaming around. He owns several wild beasts. Todd, what would you not like to see in your bathroom at 3 a.m.?
Well, I was going to say alligator, but I'm going to go with grizzly bear.
Who wins, one grizzly bear or 50 raccoon? There's something to that, right?
No, nope, that's not a thing.
No.
Gabe Roth, fix the court. How would you fix this situation? What do you not like about an animal? What animal do you not like on the floor of your bathroom?
Rattlesnake. It's got to be a rattlesnake. Had a couple of incidents where I saw them on hikes out west and just still have bad memories of that. So add alcohol to that and it'd be nightmares for me.
Damn. Lisa, drunken animal that you least like to encounter in the Badlands of Indiana?
A coyote.
Okay.
Skinny dogs, you know?
I think I could deal with that.
Yeah.
Give them a treat. Give them a beg and strip and be done with it. Tina, you love animals. You love cats.
I love animals. I love dogs. I love cats. I love a lot of animals, birds. I've had fish. I've had all of them. I'd say in terms of just sheer, like, unattractive nature, possum. Those guys are ugly. And I think in some ways they're almost like the ugly stepsister of raccoons. You often find them together. And I've actually, when I had a live trap set outside my house to try to deal with a pesky situation, we ended up trapping a possum, and those things are super ugly and are protected by, so I think it's state ordinance. You cannot destroy possum. You have to take them in their cages and free them out in the wilderness.
It doesn't take much for them to look drunk either, right? They pretty
right,
pass
exactly.
out. If you look at them funny, they pass out. Yeah.
Is it possum or opossum?
What's it's possum. No. Oh, I think it's just possum.
Is there something called an opossum?
No,
there is.
No.
Where?
As you know, I love all sorts of beasts, including Seeky, but I would pick probably I think I would be alternately scared and also happy if there was like some kind of chimp, some kind of monkey, because on the one hand they'd be scary, but you know, you could go out partying with them. You know, once the monkey sobers up a little, you throw them you take a walk down to the local, you know, pub, and the monkey would be a good drinking buddy, I think.
I've grown a new hatred, by the way, for pigeons everywhere. I couldn't imagine walking into a bathroom where it was just full of pigeons. That would drive me insane as well.
Yeah, a lot of poop.
There would be quite. Well, this was riveting, guys. Special thanks to Todd Beresford and Gabe Roth for joining us on Legal Face-Off. Also, thanks to Mary Ellen O'Connell. She is the Robert and Marion Short Professor of Law and Professor of International Peace Studies, Kroc Institute at the University of Notre Dame. Todd Huntley, Director of National Security Law Program and a lecturer in law at Georgetown University Law Center, and the Interim Director of the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund, Jim Trexler. Also, special thanks to Ben Anderson, Lisa Stiegel for making us sound smart and sound good. And for Tina Martini, Rich Lenkoff, I'm Ryan Breaux. Thanks again for joining us on Legal Face-Off on WGN.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Lenkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face-Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget.